We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
Network podcast. This made we the on podcast dwarf red the comatose and shipwrecked to welcome North Kurt is name my is me with.
That was really impressive. I didn't prepare for this.
Is me with
Colin. Prepare for this. Did you not?
That wasn't very good either, Colin. I didn't even try. I'm not going to.
It was shite, wasn't it?
It was shite.
Anyway, I'm back. I'm back. Sorry, my I had a circuit loose. And I was apparently saying things backwards. This episode is Emo Hawk Polymorph 2. And is Series 6, Episode 4. Directed by Andy D. Emney. And written by Rob Grant and Doug Naylor. Originally aired on the 28th of October, 1993. Now, Adam's Mark, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Hello.
And Helen, apparently, on the thing. But,
Belen's Bauble.
But Belen Bauble. Bauble. Bauble and Bell.
All right.
How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad.
Good, good.
His name's Colin, by the way. We haven't actually mentioned that.
It is. I'm just using my wife's laptop, so it says Helen on the screen.
Hi, Colin. You guys.
Hello.
Hello, Colin. Anyway, yes, so as you may have guessed, as I even mentioned at the top there, we're talking Emo Hawk. And, yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed that opening. You know, it took a lot of thing. I mean,
working out.
At some point in season 8, someone's got to say the end where Kat's rhyming off the chemical element in Red Dwarf 8.
Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, right, whatever. I'll start learning it now, then.
Yep.
Yeah, so we're talking Emo Hawk today, but how are things? You know, it's only downhill from here for Mark. You know, he's at the epitome last week.
Well, you say that. All of Series 6 is, like, fucking brilliant.
Yeah. Then it's a bit more downhill.
Yeah, Series 7 was a disappointment, wasn't it?
But perhaps we'll find stuff we dig in it. We'll find out.
It was as disappointing as getting cottage cheese when you thought you got cottage cheese with pineapple chunks. I did a good reference.
The thing for me is, season 7 is where we're going to get really interesting. I know we're just beyond the halfway point of season 6. Series 7 has all kinds of different versions of the show. So it's like, how are we going to approach that is an off-air conversation, but it's certainly going to be an interesting one when we get there.
It's going to be a lot of fun finding out.
That was a reference as well, Colin.
I know. I did a reference.
You did.
Yeah. So, Polymorph 2, Emo Hawk.
Speaking of references, our sign-off, have we been praising to the what's the word?
Kinatawawi?
Yeah, the Kinatawawi. But have we been praising the ex-wife of Craig,
Mister? Not actually the ex-wife of Craig Charles.
As far as we know.
Yeah, it's just her name.
Because we have, haven't we? Because it's like...
Yeah, it's just her name. That's been our sign-off for the last however the many fucking episodes. 60?
I was thinking that earlier. There might be some people that... There may be some Guelphs that speak Kinatawawi who are listening to this particular podcast. And they're like... It's as if we ended the podcast every week by saying, like, Barry.
Well, it'd be Sally, like not Barry. She was a girl.
Or Sally, yeah.
So we'd be saying something like Sally or Pauline or Barbara.
Stella. Or Stella from Streetcar Desire. Like, Stella!
That's basically what we've been doing. I mean, you didn't know that, Kurt.
No, I did, but I reminded myself of it when I was watching the episode going, well, actually, we're not actually saying anything in the language, but it is literally the name, isn't it?
So. Yeah, we could have gone for Chachum Babo, which means smug metal git, but we didn't.
Oh, I wanted to say that one.
So wonderful. So wonderful.
It is Star Trek's version. It is like their version of Klingon, isn't it?
Yeah. definitely.
Yeah.
That does make sense, yeah. I wonder if it, do you think you could learn Guelph?
I don't think they put quite enough into it.
They didn't.
There's not enough verbs.
They didn't put enough into it in Klingon to begin with. They just kind of retroactively expanded it. Maybe we could do that.
I know there was a Klingon dictionary in the early 90s because.
Just like the way the colonists.
Mate of mine had that.
Yeah, anyway, carry on the conversation. Just make him forget.
He probably knew I was going to ask him to do it. That's why he moved on as quickly
as
he could.
I'm not fucking doing it. Just because my beard makes me look most like a Kinatawawi than the rest of us.
You are a bit Kinatawawi-esque.
Yeah. Ginger, massive beard. Yeah, I can see that.
You're not as tall as Ainsley Harriet, though.
No, I'm not at all.
No.
Perhaps I'm just the emo hawk. So, this episode was originally called Polymorph 2, Emo Hawk. Nil. It sounded too much like a football score, so they swapped it round.
It's funny you should say that, because in this episode, Rimmer mentions no score draws. And it's like, I haven't heard that phrase for years. Because it used to be on the, you know, the Vidi printer. Games. Liverpool, nil. Vanilla, nil.
Do they not do that anymore? I don't pay any attention to football.
It was in like sort of the thing at the bottom, wasn't it? It says there are seven, no score draws.
Didn't that fella die?
I don't think I've ever heard that.
Didn't that fella die? The guy. Didn't he die?
Is that his name?
All right, Wolverhampton Wanderers. All right, Wolverhampton Wanderers, one. Blackpool Rovers, nil. That guy, I just was, whatever.
I don't know.
Blackburn Rovers.
What? I don't fucking know. Los Angeles Rams, whatever the fuck. As if I know about the kickball.
The kickball. Anyway,
I commentated on a football match once. Obviously, I was the comedy fucking idiot, but it was a charity football match. And they asked me to commentate on it because I do wrestling commentary. And I was like, no, I'll be shit. That would be funny. Do you still want to do it? All right. I called it.
Do you just like saying like the
I did
the
I
ball?
Did yeah at one point I obsessed about it was a wrestler they were all wrestlers in the match and I obsessed about how one of them looks like Harry Potter because he told me not to say that he looks like Harry Potter.
I remember like it's like a low league cup game and Carlisle United actually got to the final and the commentators were that bored. They started talking about what sandwiches they had that night and stuff. It was like, what are you talking about? And it even got to the point that we played football like the following afternoon. And it was like, if you lose a sandwich if you hit it over the bar. It got that bad. But anyway, yes, we're here to talk about Polymorph 2, Emo Hawk. Or Emo Hawk, colon, Polymorph 2.
Indeed.
Depending on how you want to view it. First up then, Colin. Bringing the polymorph back,
yeah,
a slightly different version. It's a spayed and domesticated polymorph as well.
It's like a little bird version.
Well, when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. The original polymorph was like a tiger or a lion, and the emo hawk is like my cat Pesha.
Strike one.
Can Pasha turn into a slinky?
But no, the metaphor is strong. I've never seen her do it. But the metaphor's strong, right?
Yeah.
Let's go straight into it. We begin this episode with a drill that's occurring, and Lister is not playing ball whatsoever. And the fact they're using the word scramble, 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 scramble. Bacon and beans, man. Bacon and beans. So what's your breakfast of choice? Do you have breakfast?
I do.
What do you have?
Marmite on toast, usually.
Marmite on toast?
Yeah.
That works.
That's what I've always had as my normal breakfast of choice, so it's probably a meal I've eaten more often than any other meal in my entire life. Because I have it for lunch sometimes as well, if I can't be asked to do anything else.
So you have a breakfast and lunch, Marmite and toast?
Occasionally.
Okay.
If I'm feeling particularly lazy and can't be asked to make a sandwich.
You know the Marmite thing about how you're supposed to love it or hate it? I quite like it.
You're indifferent.
I like it a little bit more.
Ambivalent on Marmite.
No, I'm not ambivalent.
but quite like in America, it actually means you really like it.
Well, I can go months without Marmite, but when I have some Marmite, I'm like, oh, I quite like Marmite. So I'm a bit of a A bit of a... You're not supposed to be able to do that with Marmite, are you? But I've always been a weirdo.
Yeah.
It's all a branding exercise at the end of the day, isn't it?
Yeah.
Those my breakfast of choice tends to be, oh, fucking hell, I'm late, I'll just grab some orange juice.
That's not fucking breakfast.
I know, right?
That's not fucking breakfast.
No, I know.
You two are rubbish at breakfast.
But I do, I do have a bacon sandwich available to me from the petrol filling station at which I have worked and work for the company, because they've got a petrol filling station attached to my business. So, you know, I can have a bacon sandwich if I need a sausage sandwich, Cumberland sausage sandwich.
Yeah, really nice. Yeah.
If someone else cooks me breakfast, it's Eggs Benedict. But that involves actually going to a restaurant for Eggs Benedict. But, oh, Eggs Benedict. If you could just, like, go, like fucking Star Trek, replicator shit. Or the... Why Star Trek? We're talking about Red Dwarf. They do it in that as well.
I was thinking today, that.
Today's breakfast is trout a la creme.
That's a deep dive for a long
right,
time
right, but if I can...
we haven't talked about that
I know,
episode
so,
for a
right,
long
if I if I if I was the cat, it would be... Eggs Benedict. Enjoy your meal, thank you. And then I'd become a mess.
I will.
Yeah. And Eggs Benedict is lovely. I just can't be asked to make it, for one.
It's the scrambling, and it takes 1 hour, 17 minutes.
And 39 seconds.
And 39 seconds. Yeah. I mean, just the sheer fact that Rimmer's trying this on. And we do also get the red alert thing as well. So the red alert bulb is still there.
Yeah, you know, they haven't changed it back.
Hasn't changed it back. You know, they didn't have it. You weren't here, Colin, for the first couple of episodes. It's not in the first episode.
Nope.
Rimmer has obviously, in my headcanon, like I said at the time, in my headcanon, Rimmer has been pushing this for a number of days, number of hours, to get it finally done, and then that's when the blue alert thing comes on. But now he's getting to the point of drill. So if that's not continuity, I don't know
right?
Yep.
Crichton, obviously, when we do get to the point of, like, sort of, he's talking about many things of, like, saying, you think I'm this and you think I'm that. And in many ways, you're right. And he got, but in the middle of that, with Crichton just nodding his head. Just
that's great. Yeah, yeah, it's another brilliant visual bit of Robert Llewellyn being amazing.
Mm. I've said it in the last episode, I think, it's the visual gags that I think really make it for Red Dwarf. And again, how I talked about how quotable Red Dwarf tends to be the cat, the visual gags tend to be Crichton.
He's just fantastic at it, yeah.
There's episodes in Dave where they just totally use the way that it happens in Seven as well, just the way that Crichton moves.
Yeah,
it's like satirical, you know, slapstick like humor, and they use it to great effect in a lot of ways.
We even touched on that when we started talking about series four, how it was almost like you can't really say found his voice because it's all about his actions rather than the way he speaks. But in series four, we've already said that he kind of really hits the Crichton that we know.
He became the character, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
And we were talking about visual gags, and I've said this a few times on certain things, like, you know, the whole alphabet spaghetti kind of aspect, and the Winnie the Pooh stuff, and the Rimmer's mom on a little pencil head and all that type of thing. We also get something that's a bit more like risque. When he's talking, and I'd like to get your opinion on the bit, this section, where he says about, yeah, I've got hair like yours, Rimmer, but just not on my head.
Yeah. It's not a wig, though, is it? It is Chris Barry's hair.
Yeah, it is. I just like, so that's stemming from Rimmer's, basically, speech about sensible haircuts.
Mm.
Yes, going, which is where I'm coming up to next, which goes back to the no score draw thing. So you've got, like, he talks about the US cavalry and the girly hippie look.
So girly hippie locks is something that I say all the time. I used to, believe it or not, I actually used to have very, very long hair as early 20s before it didn't work anymore.
Well, this is what I wanted to say is absolutely... Fuck off,
yeah,
with your fucking sensible haircut rant. Admittedly, the three of us have pretty much as short hair as it is possible to have. But that is through genetics and not fucking choice.
And I always used
or
to...
It definitely is in
my case.
Yeah,
me too, but I always used to describe my hairdo as girly hippie locks. Because I was comfortable enough in my masculinity, but also wanted to quote Red Dwarf.
Long hair is fucking
ain't
cool.
It just...
I would still have it if I
yeah,
could.
Yeah, me too, me too.
But he mentioned the US cavalry. He mentions ancient settlements, and he also mentions the pudding basins.
Yep.
And the Vietnam crew cuts, which is a great line. It says, Vietnam crew cuts, both sides, no score draw, which is where that comes in from. And then obviously we get a couple of bits, like sort of Kat saying about the hula hoop champion and McGrath skirt on a fat hula hoop champion.
Yeah. Which,
they've done worse.
A little bit not cool.
They've done worse, probably in last episode. And we get this kind of like thing. It's been reoccurring a lot. As you say, a soft reboot. It's been reoccurring quite a bit in the last couple of episodes in series six. Is that the cat's ability to smell? We talked about it last week with the 6 million, 200 million, 300 million aspect. And we get a little bit here. And obviously, there's a reason for that later in the episode. But we do have the cat actually being sort of smelling some sort of danger and stuff like that. So that's something that's new to Kat. And we know we've talked about Kat in the past with, you know, how he's become more humanized. But this is an element they seem to push more in these
it
later series.
It seems to me as a little bit of a sonic screwdriver that they only use when it suits them. But it's still an interesting aspect that they've added to the cat. And like I said in the last episode, cats have got great sense of smell compared to people. So it's worth referencing.
Not as good as an elephant.
No. But cats have got nicer faces than elephants.
Elephants' faces are proper cool.
They are, but they're not as pretty as a cat. I like cats.
I believe you do. Have you got a cat?
I have. She's beautiful. Her name's Pasha.
Okay. That's two. I'm starting to do ASMR now, aren't I? This is my new
ASMR? I didn't know you were into that. Good for you, each to their own. I don't judge.
I'm not Mark, but, you know, your webcam camera might go off again. We're talking about Kurt's midnight bath.
Well, what is ASMR? I was making a joke about sex.
What ASMR is?
Yeah, what is it?
You know what it is, don't you?
No.
It's like whispering and crinkling paper. And
people get, like, sort of turned on by certain aspects of, like, people whispering or crinkling.
Oh, it was a sex thing.
Paper and stuff like that.
Yeah. In some ways. I think some people don't see it as that, but
yeah.
I thought you meant ADR, but that's a different thing, isn't it?
That's an additional dialogue recording.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's not a sex thing, as far as I'm aware.
Fucking acronyms.
People actually have a reaction to various different things. So, like someone who really, I mean, even something as simple as like, you know, my partner likes to have the fan on at night, and it's the noise just to, like, that soothes her. So it's just things like that. I mean, I was a big music person going to sleep, but the fan won, unfortunately. So I listen to the fan instead. But I have been looking, I don't know if I mentioned it on this podcast, but I have been listening to some bilingual stuff. What's it called? Bi-audio?
Binaural?
Binaural, that's the word.
Yeah.
I've been listening to some binaural stuff, and man, my fucking dreams have been weird. Oh, seriously, they've just some random stuff happening. Apparently, a lot of people use it to dream, actually. Oh, what's it called?
Lucid dreaming?
Yes, the word.
Yeah?
I'm doing that right now, I think.
Where you can control it. I've been asleep for hours.
I think I remember talking about this when we did the dream episode of Red Dwarf. What's that called? Thanks for the memory. I don't remember any of my dreams, so I've got nothing to contribute to this conversation. I'm a little bit jail that you both got dreams.
But that's the thing. I didn't until I started doing this binaural stuff.
Oh.
So I've kind of dropped off a little bit, but it's basically something to do with having two frequencies in separate ears that are slightly different, and your brain makes up the third one. So you're hearing a third frequency, it doesn't exist. And something cognitive happens in your brain. But when I started doing it, after about the second day, I just had this massively vivid dream. And I'm the same as you, Mark. I don't tend to have dreams. So it was just really, really strange. Really strange.
I might give that a go. If it scares the shit out of me, I'll only give it a go once.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. just go on YouTube or like Spotify or wherever and just type in binaural. You'll find stuff on there. Just make sure you've got both ears in, go to sleep and see what happens.
You might get a Pearl Jam album because one of their albums is called Binaural.
I mean, there are worse albums to have.
Anyway,
Queek shows up.
I didn't say it because I knew one of you fuckers' words. I would really like Queek to turn up in like a future episode. I don't think he does, but I'd like Queek to turn up.
Space Corps Directives, we mentioned last week about the one which wasn't. It was more of it to do with prisoner of war, but we do get another one here. And it's something to do with a live chicken and a rabbi.
Yes. Don't have time for that kind of sacrifice. I'm not entirely sure that rabbis generally do that. I think that's more of a voodoo thing.
Yeah, there's a number of different religions across the world that still do animal sacrifice, but Judaism never did. So it does seem a little bit of an odd thing. Is it possibly speculating on how religions change over time and it's a bit more of a dig than we realise?
Could be.
Because they have been quite anti-religious in the past on this show.
I think it was just a random selection of words that they chose to use.
They would have probably be a little more sensitively chosen these days, but again, it's another one that we can go, but it's not horrific. It's certainly not as bad as the comment about the Wailing Wall, which is actively offensive towards Jewish people, you know?
Yeah. I think if a Red Dwarf, and which happens quite a lot, it does feel like that fruit machine that they've just pull the lever and just see what words come out sometimes. Because we mentioned a few weeks ago about Belgians and all kinds of...
Magnetic poetry on the fridge.
Yeah.
The word uncloaking gets used here as well, which is a very Star Trek term, which kind of threw me out of the episode quickly. It's not something listening back to the show as normal I wouldn't actually pay that much attention to, but as just a critical watch, I was like, oh, uncloaking. It's quite a Star Trek term. And they've got it out for the Country and Western channel as well. I mean, do you like a good bit of Country and Western, Cole?
A bit of outlaw country I can dig. Stuff like Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
That's not what Johnny Cash sounds like.
No. But yeah, Johnny Cash is ace. General sort of generic pop country. Fuck no.
Who's the little gay black guy that does really kind of controversial country shit? I like that he exists. I don't like his music, though.
I can fucking picture him now.
Lil
and I can't
something,
think of
it,
but... Yeah. It's not Bo Peep.
No. Is it Lil Nas X?
That's
I like him. I hate his music. I love that he exists, though. And I love that he upsets don't want no gays doing country music. I love that he upsets those people.
That's the thing. He very much pisses off the right people.
Yes. Yes, exactly right. And, you know, I like Dolly, but mainly because Jolene is a banger. And Jolene, 9 to 5, and the one that Whitney Houston covered. And that's about my knowledge. But I like those three.
I like it. She's definitely a very good person and does a lot of very, very, very cool stuff. But I'm never going to put one of her records on.
Not even 9 to 5?
It's all right.
What a way to earn a living.
I've been at Glastonbury when she was playing there and wasn't watching her.
I was at that Glastonbury and I went to see Dolly.
I was watching someone else on another stage at the time.
Rude. It was fucking Dolly.
I've got a female friend singer who sings all the Dolly stuff. She's really good, but it's not my cup of tea. Sorry. I don't actively go out to the pub to watch her, put it that way. You know, if I happen to be walking past, then yeah, maybe I might go in, but only for a few minutes. It's like similar to blues stuff, really. And blues obviously is really good. I went to see Gary Moore and I lasted for about 25 minutes. And I was like, I can't. You know, he's brilliant. What a player. What a fantastic person. But it was just like, I've seen this now.
Yeah. No,
I need to get out of here. But,
unless it's Hendrix, then, you know, could watch him play blues for hours.
So Queek doesn't turn up, but the Space Corps filth does. Now, this is interesting from a logistical point of view. They're saying about looting derelicts, which again is linked into the previous episode that we've been talking about. But we do find out there is some sort of, in this deep space anyway, and by penalty of death as well, that you've got some automatic space core police around, which opens the universe out a little bit. And I quite like the fact that, you know, it's only just it's there as kind of like a one liner kind of thing, and just, you know, using it as a way to get into the episode. But the fact that we do have this is interesting from a world building perspective. And a lot of things I was thinking about recently. Have you seen the trailer for the new Bel Air?
No.
No. Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
Not interested. The original was too good.
So what they've done, though, which I find fascinating, is that they've gone down the route of, actually, it's a drama. So Will Smith is producing it. So it's the same concept, but it's a really dark drama.
Darker and edgier version of The Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
You'd be surprised how dark and edgy The Fresh Prince got.
I know there was the episode about why didn't his dad want him and all that. That was very, very sad.
A lot of stuff about racism as well. That was really heavy, man.
But this is going for like a proper like HBO kind of, you know,
The
idea.
Wire.
But it made me think about Red Dwarf as like a premise. You know, I think I was listening to, I was reading something on Red Dwarf, and obviously thinking about what we've discussed about the books. How it's like, you can imagine like sort of the world that's being built around Red Dwarf. You can imagine that being quite a big drama based sci-fi, you know, rather than being a thing. So I find that interesting. I think we might touch upon that more when we get to review the books and things. But
But
anyway, the space core filth. So, you know, they've had a bit of a problem, which I alluded to at the beginning of this episode by reading stuff backwards. And the way Lister just goes, yeah, we didn't do that. We just tacked it our way in and swiped what we needed, which is very, very typical Lister.
I mean, I guess that goes along the lines of, I'm going to paraphrase, but there was a line that I can't even remember where it's from, but one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And that kind of goes along those lines, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's whatever your point of view is. Mm.
Evil people aren't just evil for a reason. They've got a reason to believe that, unless you're certain people.
Like me!
Yeah, so there's no mercy in this land. You know, we've got the Gels, we've got, you know, we've got various of the simulants, we've got the Red Dwarf crew, and we've got the Kinitawawi in shortly. But they even say, I think, I can't remember who says it, I think it's Rimmett says that we're as guilty as the man behind the grassy knoll.
Yes.
But I wonder who that could be, I wonder.
Ah, very much so.
Yeah.
I wonder if we'll find that out in the future.
Yeah.
Shh. Spoilers.
Spoilers.
For a show that's 30 years old.
Where have we got here? So what have I got on that note? We can't let you do that Dream On Metal Trash. What happened there?
Oh, that's... Oh, yeah. Crichton saying he's going to...
Sacrifice himself.
Yeah. Says he can blame it on him. He's held people at gunpoint. It's a very noble thing for Crichton to do, isn't it? It's something that, you know, very true to the character.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's always done stuff like that. And it's almost, but not quite the same level as the, you know, the Space Corps directives, the nose gag, the repeated humour. They do have quite a few. Crichton says he's going to sacrifice himself, and Rimmer says something mean and allows him to. Yeah, exactly that. They do it a few times, but it's not quite one of the classics, is it?
Yeah, that's one of the things. I think what I'm finding with Series 6 is, and you alluded to it, Colin, actually, is that the jokes are thick and fast, but there's not really... There is substance to some of the stuff, and we have talked about it, but early series, we were talking in depth about certain things they were trying to say.
Yeah.
And that seems to have, like... in this kind of soft reboot that like we've kind of muted here, it's kind of changed a little bit. It's more like just gags in some ways.
There's not so much of a message that there is in some of the earlier episodes, I suppose. I hadn't really thought.
No,
that,
I hadn't, but I agree with it. Now you've said it.
It just, because when I've been making notes for the two episodes I've done so far, I've looked at it and I struggle to grasp onto stuff that I would normally have grasped onto quite easily.
But what you did say is that there is more gags for your time frame. So something clearly had to go if they were going to put more gags in.
Definitely. I mean, I'm not saying it's a detriment to the episodes because it's not, but it just seems interesting that what I'm looking for in a Red Dwarf is like some of the deeper stuff, and it's not really there. It's not. I'm not really finding it. But at the same time, it's still brilliant in what it's doing. It just seems like it's me rhyming off gags.
Right. Can I just pause for a second? Pasha has trodden on my printer's power button, and it's getting the printer is now going to make a lot of noise. So we're going to need to pause while I switch the printer back off.
Because of Pasha's pause.
You do realise that now you said Pasha pause, that I'm going to use that, and then we're going to put some like sort of waiting music on while we wait. That was the Pasha pause. Thank you for holding. Right, where were we before Pasha decided to get involved in the situation?
I believe we were round about the hit the reheat bit.
We were talking about hitting the reheat. We were talking about the warning shot and the decoys launched.
Well, I don't think we've got to that yet. We were just about to.
We're just about to get there.
Yeah.
So we are in the Gelf zone, and we have to... Sorry, I do love this bit. You don't have to tell me twice.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
So hit the reheat.
Turns out you do have to tell me twice. It is a great line. It's a great line.
And then there is an explosion.
Yeah.
And Danny John-Jules actually got injured in that explosion.
Did he?
You can see him holding his face. As it panned, he's right on the edge of the shot, and I think they've panned it a bit so it doesn't show so much of him. But yeah, for a second you can see him holding his face, and then it cuts, and then he's all right a bit later. But yeah, the explosion I think was a little bit too close to his face, or he got some debris that hit him or something.
Oh dear.
Luckily he was okay.
That scene has a gag that I think is just so funny and also so sci-fi, is the damage report machine being taken out so he can't continue with the damage report. Yeah. That was brilliant.
Well, just before that, when he's listing the damage that the damage report machine has told him, which is all stuff that he'd be able to see anyway.
Yes.
Like there's loads of smoke, the console's fizzing. Oh, now the damage machine's gone as well.
So clever.
And then going back to Star Trek, I apologise, Colin. There's two things that I always remember from Star Trek that's just like just ridiculous in relation to this. There's one where I can't think if it's Star Trek 4 potentially, where they go to the damage report machine and he points at like this where the damage is, and it's like I think it's Rafa Khan, and he gets asked to point at it, and it's just like that. Why have you done that? You know, it's like, look at the damage here. And it's like, it's like just an image of the Starship Enterprise. It's in these points. And it's like, that's awful. And then there's another one in The Best of Both Worlds, which is the Borg episode in Star Trek Next Generation, where Worf rhymes off a thing of Vigala damage. And he says something like, structural lighting integrity breached. And I always instantly think, what, the lights have turned off? You know, that's right. It's like all this sci-fi geek, like sort of like noise of like this happened, that structural integrity, blah, 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 make it sound really important. And I'm like, if you break down those words, that effectively the lighting has turned itself off. It's been blown up, and that's it. And I just find it amazing.
It's a bit dark.
But yeah. It's a bit dark. It's a bit dark in that area. You know, the damage machine's not working, which is a classic. That's kind of like your airplane kind of humor, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of like, you know, wordplay kind of stuff.
Which controversially, I like that gag more than it does mean changing the bulb.
I think that's fair. They're both brilliant. You know, there's a very high barrier for jokes in Series 6. So, you know, there's a lot of really good stuff in there.
I mean, in this episode itself, we've got the red alert bulb, so, you know, it's all good.
Yeah.
So the Gelf zone, you mentioned this at the beginning, Mark, about the skull, you know, in the first couple of episodes about the opening credits and stuff, and we get to find out what it is here. So we have the warning shot and the fact that the decoys are launched. Do you think they've had decoys from last episode Or do you think they had decoys before?
Oh, you mean the upgrade?
Their ship was enhanced.
Yeah. I think that was also a bit of a, you know, a MacGuffin to make them a little bit more fighty for the rest of the series, as well as to be able to progress the plot of the Gunman of the Apocalypse. Yeah, I think, they've basically got lasers now, haven't they?
Which is cool. Lasers are badass.
Yeah.
There was an interesting bit, I thought, in this bit, where the measurements that they use for things. I always thought that there's a one in an earlier episode where Lister says something about G-gooks, which is made up.
G-gooks and clothes.
Yeah. That's made up. But in this one, they say, how far away from the Gulf Zone are we? And Lister says 7 clicks. And I thought that was a made-up thing, but I looked it up, and clicks is actually a military term. And it,
yeah, is it a nautical term?
No.
It's military.
It's military. It's a kilometre. So they're only 7 kilometres away. And then 54 seconds later, he says they're 6 clicks away. So they're travelling at less than 60 miles per hour, which is a lot slower than you would expect a spaceship to travel at. They then speed up a little bit because I worked out then the next bit that they managed to travel to the Gulf asteroid thing, which I calculated that at 168 miles per hour, which is still really fucking slow for a spaceship. my car could overtake Starbug.
You're
not when it's going really fast. I couldn't do 168 miles per hour, but 60 miles an hour, I can go faster.
Your pedantry is magnificent, Colin. I love this.
Also, the Gulf warning beacon that comes through. Did you notice that it's the exact same voice actor as the Space Corps enforcement thingy?
Oh, shit, is it?
They're both played by Hugh Quashy, who. Most famously, he played a character in Casualty and Holby City for years, a character called Rick Griffin. I've never watched it, but he was in like 604 episodes or something, so I think that's most of them. But what I know him from is he's Captain Quash Panaka in Star Wars Episode One: Phantom Menace. He's Queen Amidala's head of security, the guy with the red leather
Good
jacket
grief.
And the hat thingy. That's Hugh Quashy.
They do talk in the commentaries about how anyone who does a guest appearance on Red Dwarf becomes more famous than the four of them.
Yeah.
And it looks like there might be something to it.
Yeah.
I think Danny John-Jules is probably closest with Blade, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it could well be.
But you're talking about like that damage report as well. We also had the where Rimmer lost it. Sorry, I was looking at the wrong panel. as well, which is another great gag. The moon itself, actually, you know, as I mentioned about seeing that skull moon, it's kind of like they use that loosely, and I'm kind of like sort of using the word which they didn't quite use, kind of like a gargoyle.
Yeah,
so it's a way of warding off people. And then it actually does say that, isn't it? It's this Gulf space, deaf to the stranger, is the call that we get out there. And we land on that moon again, talking about Smegups. We get the actual damage that's caused after the explosion and things like that, where between fire, flood, and impact damage, you know, it's we really, you know, that's basically it. And
there's a bit to mention just before that. One of the only swear words of this level in Red Dwarf, because Kat says, "Does mouse shit roll?"
Yeah, he does.
Yes. Which seems quite jarring. I mean, they've said, like, let's get out there and twat it before, but it's the only time I know of that anybody ever says shit. And I checked, mouse shit is sort of rice-shaped, so probably doesn't roll.
Of course you checked. I was thinking it was like the little balls that rabbits do.
Yeah, but that's rabbits, not mice.
I know, but I can't see mouse shit because it's small.
Yeah.
I didn't spot that at all.
If we're doing plotting a graph of who swears the least, I'm the least.
Yeah,
it might be Carl. It's definitely me that swears the most, though.
I'm not sure. It's me or you.
It's probably me. I don't care.
Well, if the Christmas specials ain't to go by, Jesus Christ, it was word per minute.
I got excited. I did.
You did. There is such a thing called the edit button.
Yeah. Was it me that edited that? I can't even remember.
Was it anybody that edited that?
No one edited it. You just recorded it and put it out from the looks of it.
Oh, trust me, that was edited.
Anyway, Colin, I'll see you in my office after.
Yeah.
So Mouse Ship Road, no, I did not catch that. But we get get onto the planet. Mr. Guitar, which is the classic Smegol.
Yes.
Yes.
Which I've still got to mention.
This led me on a deep dive
into
Lister's guitars.
Okay.
Because he's had a few different guitars throughout the series. Has he had a
Gretsch?
No. No, he's never had a Gretsch, unless that's in a later series.
No, I think it's a Les Paul in the later series.
What's a Gretsch?
Gretsch guitars are amazing. I've got three. They're my favourite guitars. He's had... So the first couple of series, he's got a silver bowl-back acoustic that's a bit like an Ovation. But it's actually a Clarissa GB100, because most of his guitars are really cheap, which fits with the character, because he was a third technician. You know, he's going to... Unless later on he went and nicked guitars out of Captain Hollister's quarters or something like that, which I fucking would do. There'd be some nice guitars somewhere on the ship.
Yeah, that makes sense.
He had that silver bowl back acoustic. His main guitar is what he calls his genuine Les Paul copy, which is a black late 70s Antoria Pro Star.
Is that a Les Paul copy then?
Yes. There were, in the 70s and early 80s, there was a lot of Chinese, Japanese and Korean companies that were making what get called lawsuit guitars, because they were basically copies of Fender Stratocasters and Gibson Les Pauls.
Right.
And they got totally sued. But the guitars, in a lot of cases, were pretty good quality. So they're quite sought after now. You get like Hondos and stuff like that, which, you know, they made quite nice ones. But he had a, in Thanks for the Memory, he had a really nice red Ibanez Destroyer. In Legion, the guitar that turns up in that is a Dobro Lily of the Valley, which is the most expensive looking guitar that they've had, which fits because Legion's just got something that's really show-offy, because it's what Legion does. It's not one that Lister could afford himself. But then this guitar, that's supposed to be the Les Paul copy, blatantly fucking isn't. It's a Telecaster shape, which is a totally different shape to a Les Paul. It's got three single coils rather than two humbuckers. It's just really obviously not the same guitar. It's Sunburst, and it's got a... When it's smashed, you can see the scratch plate hanging off, that it's got three single coil pickups rather than two humbuckers. It's not even close to the same one.
Are you awake? I did switch off there. Are you awake? Guitars go wow, wow, wacka wow, and make music what I like. All of that.
Well, they do that if you've got a wah pedal. But yeah, I got a lot of that from
I mean, I know the telly, but it's funny how there's no Fenders there.
No, which is wrong. Fenders are ace. Fenders and Gretsches are my main guitars.
What is the best guitar in the world that's ever existed?
It depends on how you're measuring that. Because I think my Gretsch Jet Baritone is pretty fucking cool. But most people wouldn't. It's sparkly and it's got a Bigsby vibrato.
I like the one with two necks. I've seen those before. I like them. They're fun.
Yeah, double neck. Normally the Gibson SG double neck is the one that most people think of. Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin used to play a lot. So one neck's six string and the other neck is 12 string electric. But yeah, Fender Jazzmasters are pretty awesome. There are many awesome guitars.
Music man's are good.
I want to say Stratocaster.
I've got one over there, yeah. I've got a Fender Strat.
I've heard that one.
The ones you would generally heard are Les Paul and Fender.
Yeah, Gibson Les Paul, Fender Stratocaster, Fender Telecaster. They're your most famous-y type ones. But yeah, Lister hasn't got any of those. He's got mostly sort of knockoffy type ones, but this is an absolute knockoff, really cheap guitar that they'd found so they could smash it up. But it's not even close.
Well, unfortunately, because of by sheer kind of like mind jumping around all over the place, I will always kill a boy with a Fender guitar.
You're going to have to elaborate on that, Kurt.
It's a phrase from Jim Steinman talking about it on Battle of Hell 2. It's like a spoken piece, which unfortunately, as people know, Meatloaf died recently.
The recently deaded Marvin Lee Day. Yes.
Yeah. I remember everything. I remember every little thing as if it only happened only yesterday. I once killed a boy with a Fender guitar.
Ah, yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
Oh, so you didn't kill anyone. Good.
No.
I'm
no,
glad.
No, I did. I did.
I like the fact for about 2 minutes there you thought I'd killed
no,
a boy.
No, you
with
said
a
nearly.
Guitar.
You didn't say you had.
Nearly.
I'm not getting your references. They're not geeky enough. They're like for cool people who know how to play the guitar.
Because you're a cacumbabo.
And just for the record, I've got a Music Man Stingray. What is this one actually? It's a Warwick.
Oh, nice.
Five string Warwick. And I've got a Precision, Fender Precision.
Cool.
Do you know what I've got? A fucking kazoo. That is literally the only musical instrument I have. A kazoo.
The reason why this is all happening, because Mr. Guitar's not in.
Oh, Mr. Guitar.
Oh, Mr. Guitar. The fact that they've got to fix everything, they can get up and running. He's been in Waders for 3 hours as Lister, and he has to... The only issue that they've got is they've got no oxygen, so they need to go and get an Oxygon unit, which means that they're going to have to go out there and go and see the Kinitawawi.
It's an OG unit, which...
It's an OG unit.
Very much sounds like the original version of 50 Cent Supergroup G unit. It's the OG unit.
It's the original.
Yeah.
These were the original.
Yeah, that's members. Not what it meant in 1993.
It is, definitely. They were predicting the future again, like they were with predicting Red Dead Redemption in the previous episode.
Is that
episode.
Right?
Yeah.
So GTA and Red Dead Redemption, last episode.
Technically, L.A. Noir for the first bit of the last episode.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
Yeah, it was L.A. Noir.
But yeah.
No, I did complete L.A. Noir.
So anyway, Ainsley Harriet turns up.
We didn't mention Ainsley in the last episode.
No, because he's in this one.
Oh, yeah.
I've not got there yet.
I got excited. I wanted to talk about Ainsley.
Is Ainsley in the Western?
That would have been good.
That would have been great if he was in both episodes.
Do you remember when we did Can't Smeg, Won't Smeg? I spent a week putting GIFs of Ainsley being weird on Twitter. I fully plan to do that again.
Excellent.
Classic cut lines with the arrow. It's a particularly memorable thing.
That was funny. That was really funny.
Yeah.
That gag could have worked if he was taking the piss as well, but he wasn't. And that was funny in a different way.
Talking about, actually, there's a moment here where they talk about drunken fry-ups as well, just while I remember. It's just come up in my notes. And we talked about breakfast this morning. We talk about drunken fry-ups. Do you actually, when you have in your past, got really drunk, gone home and made a fry-up?
I don't drink and never have done, so no. But I have got home from the pub when I've just been out late at night, not drunk, and made Marmite and toast.
Is it possible that you've had three?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was known as the Toast Ghost.
Nice. Drunken fry-ups, no.
I wouldn't. I would always go to the kebab shop or the pizza shop.
Pizza was always my thing on the way home of choice, particularly since I've gone veggie. A kebab would not be a good look. That would be very un-veggie. I've tried to think if I've ever cooked drunk. I've definitely put chips in the oven, gone to sleep, and had the oven on all night like a badass, dangerous motherfucker. But
well, that's what he's saying here, isn't it? Because he's saying about the fact that he's left
those chips did not look pretty 9 hours later.
My friend did a pizza, and it was like the size of a 10-pence piece by the time
a 10-pence pizza.
A 10-pence pizza, yeah. None of this 9-inch, 10-inch, 13-inch crack. It was like literally the size of a 10-pence piece. So you can going back to the arrow, the Kinitawawi are actually quite a nice section of the Guelph society, apparently.
Because they don't kill them on sight.
They don't kill them on sight. So that was handy for them, wasn't it? That was nice.
It helps us get more episodes.
Just a little bit. What I really like about this is just the Del Boy aspect when they actually get there. So this land that they've come into is, again, similar to what happened last week with they've said they've got a script and they didn't have a script, is that this was on the backlot of Shepperton Studios, this area, because it was a TV show, and I can't remember what TV show is called now.
Covington Cross,
yeah, which is a medieval show.
Yeah, apparently. I've never seen it.
No, I don't think it lasted very long. From
what one series, it was mainly shown in America, although it did later get shown over here.
But it does seem to me like they've actually been quite kind of savvy with how they film these places. They borrowed someone else's set. They went to a set that was already a Western set.
Yeah.
And it looks more expensive than it probably was.
Looking for like ways to get around it. And I suppose going back to the whole thing of like they were in a rush to get stuff done, that they said find us a Western town, and they did. You know, that this was on their doorstep. Can we use it? Yes, you can.
Yeah.
It's cheap. You're able to be used.
I genuinely feel like it benefits from that, actually.
Yeah, because if they'd had to build the sets themselves, it'd put the budget massively up and they wouldn't be able to do such a good job of them.
Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
The mud huts themselves, it was done in a studio, and apparently that they were really concerned about the mud huts because they were obviously had the fire and stuff like that. It was so hot.
Right.
That they had to keep turn it off and keep restarting it and things like that. They were concerned about the Guelph hair.
Oh, shit.
Stuff like that. Which I found was amazing. Apparently, that you can see it in the episode as well. I mean, I'm just talking about, again, similar to what we did last week, talk about the actual set itself, is that you can see it in the episode, it's freezing cold, that you can see the breath on people. And apparently, even like sort of Crichton and the Guelphs were all wearing jackets.
Good grief.
Just to keep them warm. And the production manager, Kerry Waldell, actually went around people and said, would you like a drink? And people were saying like, oh no, I've got hot chocolate and stuff. And she was going, no, an actual drink, an actual some rum.
To keep them warm.
And apparently, like our good friend Colin here, Robert Llewellyn doesn't drink, but got absolutely smashed. And he couldn't actually read some of his lines, so they had to be put onto board so he could read what he was doing.
Whoops.
And then again, it comes into all comes around with like sort of the fry up stuff. The crew, instead of having the on set catering, they ordered pizzas,
right,
to be brought from a takeaway. And apparently, that they got the pizzas, got there, and they didn't want to like sort of finish filming, so they had to finish the filming before they went into it. And apparently, that the Robert Llewellyn was like crunching them up into little balls and trying to eat through his mouth because he never eats when he's got the costume on. So he was actually physically doing that as well, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah, that sounds like it was actually quite a tough time filming this.
It's can imagine. So it it's one thing extreme to the other as well. In the mud huts, the boiling hot, and then on the other side, it's absolutely freezing cold.
Yeah.
But anyway, so talking about that Del Boy thing, if we go back to the top of that part of the episode. Just the fact that he's got Swiss watches, he's got Levi jeans.
It's,
you know, it's the typical traveling salesman technique.
The combination that he's got there of the Levi jeans, the hat, and the cigar, though, makes the Kinitawawi chief look like Slash from Guns N' Roses, which has always amused me. I don't know if that was deliberate or not, but it really looks like it was. It also really reminds me of, do you remember that there was a scene in Drop the Dead Donkey that I think predates this, where Damien, the absolutely useless reporter, goes to like some kind of village in the Amazon or something, and he's trying to barter with them like giving them like a VCR and stuff like that, and they've already got them because they've had loads of other people come to visit them before.
I just want to say at this point how cool the Kineta Wawe look. They all look great.
Yeah.
And there's something that I don't know why, but I just love this idea of these kind of genetically engineered life forms that have completely rebelled and made their own society. And it's why I wanted to play one when we did the RPG Sourcebook episode.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether the other guys that I did that episode with were that into Red Dwarf and would have specifically remembered this episode. Because I was worried that when they were a player character in that game, that everyone would just want to play Kineta Wawe.
You just, because then you don't have to make up actual dialogue. You just go, I come to everyone.
So I did bring up a little story, like a little background story for the character. And it was inspired by this episode that she had married one of the crew that wasn't Red Dwarf. It was like a crew of other people in the Red Dwarf universe. There'd been a trade. She'd married him. And she was now basically his fucking bodyguard in almost like an alternative version of what happened here. And I would love to play that character. No one wants to play the Red Dwarf role-playing game with me.
I think we should do it as the next Christmas special. As I said,
I'm happy to do that as long as I can play my Kineta Wawe.
Yes.
Do you want to be my husband, Kurt?
No. I'm quite happy legging it.
That line. Change of plan. Leggy.
No, it's the line before that that's better. We're skipping right
ahead.
We are.
Yeah, but just skip it. I'll come back. We'll come back to it. It's fine. Go on.
I'm just going to go and slip into something more comfortable. It's called Starbug.
You see, I like that one, but on that scene, my favourite line is, maybe in the morning.
You've been waiting for this, haven't you?
That scene, it's wonderful.
We hear about the Ogagon unit. We and get some structure back into this. The Emo Hawk, we've talked about, it half domesticated, and we're in the Watunga, or the hut. You've got the, as I say, you mentioned the Slash stuff as well, and apparently that she's the looker. I mean, there is another looker in there, in Ainsley Harriet's character, and by all means, talk about Ainsley Harriet now if you shall wish.
Ainsley's in it!
This is 2 years before he was famous as well.
I know.
Because 1995 was when he started being a celebrity chef on This Morning, I think it was.
Mm.
And it's 17 years before he became a meme with all the GIFs on the internet. Weirdly, came up in my Facebook memories yesterday from 6 years ago. I went to Laser Quest in Acox Green in Birmingham, and they've got, like, painted on all the walls, they've got, like, you know, Predator and, you know, the Xenomorph from Alien and Robocop and stuff like that. And Ainsley Harriet.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
So, yeah. I was quite surprised the first time I found that.
There are a lot of Ainsley Harriet GIFs on Twitter. I discovered this, but we've already mentioned that. I think he must have wanted to be an actor, but could he cook? Or did he kind of, like, make cooking his actor gimmick? It's fascinating to me that this was his career before he was a cook. And
yeah, yeah. He'd appeared in a couple of comedy-type things as well before that. I've got a feeling he was maybe in... I think when I was looking on IMDb, he'd been in, like, Harry Enfield and stuff like that.
Mm.
I mean, they got through it from the Comedy Store, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's where... And I think you've mentioned before, Colin, about him going around the circuit and things.
Yeah. And my wife's met him because her cousin was on Ready, Steady, Cook.
That's cool.
And she went with her.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, but he doesn't get the lead part. You'd have thought he would have been given, you know, obviously before he was famous, but they've said, oh, well, you can stick him in the background. But you thought he would have been given the wife's part.
Exactly. The actor that plays is a big dude, and he's needed to be able to pick up Craig Charles.
Which, bigger than Ainsley.
I don't know if he's a tall guy, but is he a particularly hulking strong dude?
I'd have thought someone who cooks a lot is quite chunky.
I mean, they don't lift ovens every day, Mark. You're not like sort of...
I'm ignoring that joke because I'm not above Googling Ainsley Harriet shirtless, so I'm going to do that now.
Why is that, Mark?
Because it's research. Okay, so there is a picture of Ainsley Harriet shirtless, and he's in pretty good nick. It's not. It's a big guy.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. But was he in 1993?
I don't know. I don't know.
Anyway, your man that did do it is quite a big dude and was able to pick up Craig Charles quite easily.
Yeah, so, I mean, the guy that did do it, and obviously the actual costumes they were wearing, they were bodysuits with then a belly pack on.
Yeah.
So it was like the belly pack would come on after the fact.
Yeah.
Which is the way that ran. And as I say, even though with all that stuff on and Crichton having all his stuff on, Robert Llewellyn having all his stuff on, it was still freezing cold.
Yeah.
So you can just imagine how, you know, how bad that setting was. Obviously, Lister's looking at this and he said the fact that it mentions about poor disco lighting, which kind of hit quite interestingly.
The emphasis that he says it is really weird. He says that only due to very poor disco lighting. And it's the lighting he puts emphasis on, which is really
lack
strange.
Thereof, I suppose. But I've woken up next to people that perhaps I wouldn't have done if it hadn't been for poor disco lighting.
Yeah.
Or indeed poor indie lighting, poor metal lighting, or poor pop lighting.
And you look at some of the clubs now that are like sort of, they look like they're all like bright white with all these LEDs and stuff like that. And you're just like, oh my God, this is like, hide me now.
As if I go to nightclubs.
I don't like going to clubs.
Well, I don't. I end up in a drum and bass live event with Luke Winch from The Network when I was in Birmingham.
Is Luke surprisingly cool for his age then? Because he's my age.
We just ended up in there. We were in a pub in a village just outside of Birmingham. We ended up like...
You were in Moseley, weren't you?
Aye.
You and I, when we met up, we went to Timperley and you had six lagers and it didn't touch the side and I was fucking hungover the next night. But we just sat in a beer garden and drank lager. That sounds like Luke's really cool. I feel like I need to up my game.
But we also went to see Frank.
We did. We went to see Frank Sidebottom. But I do feel like I need to up my game and be the cool guy.
Can I just point out that the Frank Sidebottom statue that you went to see was partly paid for by Tracy from We Dig Music?
Yeah.
You have mentioned this, yeah.
She's a massive Frank Sidebottom fan.
I think we're just going to go...
We'll have to find that photo and post it again now. We've talked about it.
Yeah.
Because my family, and we've mentioned this again, live, like, you go past that Sidebottom statue, you turn left, and you head down for, what, a mile and a half past Timperley Station, and that's where my family live. Don't send any death threats. Thank you. the fact that also as well, they've been given five Hanukkah. They have been given five Hanukkah, which is apparently exactly the same
as 5 minutes. That only gives us 28 hours, says the cat.
It's really weird the way the cat, when you take a step back, it's really weird the way the cat actually is in this series. They've clearly made him brighter in a lot of ways. So jokes like that don't quite hit like they used to. And they almost seem incongruous because they have made him a bit brighter and more worldly wise. So that one...
Especially with last episode, he was right three times in a row.
Yeah, but it made me laugh, so it's fine.
Oh, yeah, it was still funny. But it didn't quite hit like it might have done in series 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the problem with Aries, by the way? Does anyone have any issues with Aries? You know, she's obviously an Aries, but...
Horoscopes are all bollocks.
Humanist horoscopes are all bollocks. I don't even entertain it. I know I'm a virgin.
I think that the point is that he's using any excuses.
Yeah. The singer from Kings of Leon was born on exactly the same day as me. So I would be a multimillionaire if horoscopes were true. And be very famous.
That doesn't make sense.
It does. He was born at the same time. That's what fucking horoscopes mean.
Maybe it's something in the water.
Yeah.
No, I just meant horoscopes don't make sense. Okay. Yeah.
No, there was a reference to a Kings of Leon song in there.
I've heard of the Kings of Leon.
It's in the water.
Yeah.
It's all right. It went over everyone's head.
It did. Cause...
Are they the one that did the hey, yeah? Meh, fire. That one.
How can you not know the title to that song? It's Your Sex Is On Fire.
Which sounds painful.
I know, right? I don't want anything on fire while I'm having sex, thank you. You need to go and see the fucking clap clinic if anything's on fire when you've had sex.
Ainsley shows up and you may kiss the bride.
Was Ainsley the bride? No, he wasn't. We said that. No.
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 It was the chief. Oh, yeah, well, that's a good part for Ainsley. Oggy yeah. gone. Yeah, that's Ainsley.
Yeah.
Right, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the sort of handshaky type thing with the
wonderful
leg shake that him and Crichton do, that was Robert Llewellyn's idea on the day.
Really?
I mean, it looks like it was because he was pissed.
Yeah. Surprised he didn't fall on his ass if he was pissed.
I know, that's what I was thinking. I was actually watching that episode before and I was like looking to see if I could see how drunk he was. And he does seem a little bit more, but I don't know if that's almost like a placebo effect.
Yeah.
You're
looking for it now. So, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, it does look a bit like wiry-eyed. What absolutely gets me every time, and it's the sheer look of the other
Kinitawawi.
Yeah, and you're going to have problems with that word. When the bouquet is full.
And the little wave.
It's the way. It's just the way. It's got a slightly more elongated face. And he's got eyes wide open. And just that little wave. It's just.
It is.
Comedy gold.
It is.
Comedy gold. It's brilliant. And the fact that the way Rimmer like just throws the bouquet at a cat. It's like, no. Which is obviously, I think that for me is quite a good mark on just weddings in general, isn't it? You know, certain people get booking away.
Yeah,
no, that's good. Or actively like sort of try and hide out in the corner. And
next
like
wedding
that.
I go to, I'm fuck. I'll elbow you in the face to get the damn bouquet. I want that.
I can just imagine like sort of like totally bombing anyone's wedding. You know, you've done the service and stuff like that, and then you just bomb the rest of it just to say, I want that.
Yeah,
bouquet.
Get me the bouquet now.
And then by 10 o'clock at night, after he's had 3 pints. You're just on the dance
floor. 2 pints, I'll be on the dance floor. Well, this is the unwritten rule of weddings, isn't it? That the homosexual has to lead the formulaic dances.
There you go. We got it, Kurt.
What?
Didn't mention it in the last episode at all.
No.
Formulaic dances?
That you're gay. You normally mention it at least one episode.
Well, there wasn't anything gay in the other ones. To be fair, there weren't any formulaic dances. How did we get on fucking formulaic dances?
Weddings.
Okay.
It's weddings. It's a really important in Red Dwarf lore, this episode.
He does?
Lister gets married.
He does?
He gets married. And not only that, there's a continuation in season 2.
Although technically, in British law, if you don't consummate the marriage, then you're not married until that's happened. I think it's British law, but it might not be, but...
Even though you've signed the documents and stuff, which
it might be
documents.
Like an old school thing that isn't actually true anymore. I mean,
you have to film it to like prove.
Hasn't there been like some like historical shit where didn't Henry VIII go, I didn't fuck her, so we're not actually married?
Yeah, but that's not a recent thing, is it?
Old British law.
I mean, you're the one that has facilitated marriages.
Don't get me started about the fact that we're trying to legalise humanist marriages. I haven't done a legal marriage ever, actually. Because the fucking registrars are a bunch of dickheads trying to protect their own interests because we're better. So no, I don't know as much about the law as I might do because I currently don't need to.
We've hit a nerve.
You have hit a nerve, yes. Fucking sorry, Boris Johnson dragging his heels. Yeah,
well,
right.
He's a prick.
But he likes a good party.
No, work event.
We have the moment where Lister says change of plan and leg it, like we mentioned before.
Wonderful.
And then we get like all men are bastards.
Oh, those subtitles are everything.
Yeah.
It's a visual gag and it's so clever.
Yeah. I think that is one of the highlights of the episode that.
You've had no subtitles for the first 10 minutes and it's just there for that one gag about the jilted bride. It's so clever. It's so clever.
That's definitely the reason why it works as well, isn't it? Because of that.
And whoever planned that gag, that's really fucking good. You did miss a line that I liked. There's no way I'm going down to Moss Bros for anyone less attractive than my own armpits after 20 games of table tennis. And...
That's another table tennis. Yeah. He says it's another really weird emphasis one.
I might be completely naive here, but you need to explain the Moss Bros thing because I've never understood it.
Moss Bros is a hire
company. It's a suit hire company.
Right,
It's relatively, probably the most famous wedding hire company in the UK, I think.
Right, okay. The issue that I've got with these scenes, I love the polymorph stuff. I really do. And I find it fantastic. And there's even like sort of like things that make me remember stuff like in Red Dwarf 8, for example, when Cat's looking around, he's not aware of his surroundings, which is quite unusual for a cat. If you're actually thinking about it, it's quite unusual for a cat not to be aware of his surroundings. So the stick thing, you know, great little gag. But Lister, Craig Childs walking with that thing on his head, and like staying as still as possible while he's watching down the thing.
It's beautiful bit of film. I love that bit with it on his head. It's hilarious. Just before that, when they're like, something's coming and they're all looking around, reminds me of, have either of you guys ever seen Birdemic Shock and Terror?
Of course I've seen Birdemic Shock and Terror.
I thought you might have. It's an amazingly bad, brilliantly hilarious, terribly made film. About clip art birds attacking people, basically,
birds.
which they then fight off with coat hangers, and it totally reminds me of that scene.
it takes me back to the Waxworld episode.
Yeah, Meltdown.
Because it kind of feels like that a little bit.
Mm.
Because it's like, oh look, it's come in. It's just like, act like there's nothing there, but act kind of thing. Which is great, but yeah, I do like the actual scenes themselves and the hat. You know, it's a wonderful scene. It's just funny that you can just see Craig Charles concentrating as hard as he possibly can, just for it to stay on his head. Blob dinghy when they come into the hatch, right? I don't know why I've never really paid attention to it before, but just thinking about it, it's something really simple. But then just the fact that he's bringing it in, it's like half blown down and brings it in. And then we obviously find out that the hat's been put down. And some of this, like, sort of, I get confused. And I think this is some of the stuff I had confusion with Red Dwarf as a whole. So things like Rimmerworld, Waxworld, and stuff like that, where you can mix and match certain elements. So in my head, I was thinking, on this particular episode, about when Lister comes in Sirens, you know, when he comes into the hatch, and it's like there's two of them. There's things like that, which, you know, it's quite interesting seeing Sirens and Polymorph being quite close together in the series run. Because as I say, I was expecting that, and then obviously saw the move the chicken thing, which is the another smeg up.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how some of the tropes of Red Dwarf do come back. You know, as I say, you've got the Wax World, Rumour World, that kind of thing, that you just seem to have. There's moments through the series where you have it. And Sirens, Polymorph, and Polymorph 2. There's aspects that are the same there as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think part of the thing about the smelling comes into play here, because at the beginning of the episode, we had Kat, like, doing that mismelling, and I'm saying he's quite sure that's the right smelling. And then we get this way, smelling the fact that something's not right, and he ends up in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And brilliantly blocked scene. You know, I just love the way that they blocked it. That, you know, he starts to like sniff under the counter. So it gives them time to like sort of give you that block shot, and obviously the change, stop the shot, and then bring Dwayne Dibley into it.
Yeah.
But out of a lot of moments, this is one of those moments you just remember. I remember seeing this for the first time ever. You know, it's just like pivotal. And the cheers they get from this scene is incredible. Yeah.
They had to reshoot multiple times because when Dwayne Dibley appears, the audience cheered so long that they couldn't get going with the rest of the show.
Brilliant.
So they had to keep reshooting it until the audience could be calm enough for them to get on with it. And even then, it's a massive cheer.
The thing I absolutely love about this scene is Danny John-Jules' timing and the utter horror in the way he delivers Dwayne Dibley. It's just the utter horror. It's so perfectly done. And yeah, who didn't want to see Dwayne Dibley back?
They actually say in the production stuff that they wanted to somehow bring him back, and that almost formulated the idea.
Right.
Like, how can we get like an alternative version of Kat in by using Dwayne Dibley, or how can we get Dwayne Dibley into the show kind of thing, and how would that work organically?
Mm.
So the fact that you know they found a polymorph, that's a perfect example. That's a great way of doing it. Less so for Rimmer. In Chris Barry's mentioned in interviews that for a number of different reasons, he would have liked to have preferred to have been in an Ace Rimmer outfit if he could have.
Right.
And it doesn't really land, and the wigs disappeared from Dimension Jump. And I think this is the biggest issue that we have with Ace Rimmer, like from this episode onwards, in like season 7, is that we don't have the original wig.
Yeah.
And the one thing I will say about this is Ace and Dwayne Dibley meeting is like a Smegazine comic in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It is. Well, it's total fan service, exactly this episode is, isn't it? You've also got Ace's brilliant description of him, where he says he's so geeky, I don't think he could even get into a sci-fi convention, which is obviously a nice little dig at a lot of the people watching it who would have gone to sci-fi conventions at the time.
The only thing I'd say, right, so this is something I picked up on this last watch as well, just before he turns into Dwayne Dibley, is he talks to himself before he gets to the thing. So he says, like, transfer into auto. You know, there's no one there.
Yeah.
So I know it's for the audience, but it just seems a bit interesting that I don't think... Well, we have heard him do it before, haven't we? Because when he says, you know, I want to have sex with something, I suppose he does that there. Going back to deep dives.
The DNA strands. Holograms don't have DNA. If the polymorph needs DNA strands, then why does it go for a hologram? There's nothing to take the DNA from.
Because that's what was written in the script.
Because they wanted to pay fan service.
They did. They did.
Yeah.
Wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
And I'm glad they did, because it's a...
It is a great episode. And then...
Because if you're being really technical with stuff, it says Dwayne Dibley says about a smell of extra strong spot cream. How would that happen in, like, because he hasn't put any on?
No.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like literally just let it change, and he's cat with everything taken out of him. He wouldn't like literally just go, like, find the spot cream, away you go. So the way, because that my next line after that spot cream stuff is the gun, and I put in the AM and Arnie J. Total like Bond-esque and stuff, and like sort of it's Arnie J. Not Ace, Arnie J.
I think if he'd have said Ace, that it would have been a bit of a
too obvious.
Yeah, exactly that.
Plus he's not Ace, is he? He is just Rimmer. He's like sort of an emboldened version of Rimmer.
Mm.
So which is another one, which is something I haven't said for a long, long time, which means it's another Rimmer.
Oh, I hope you're making notes on the number of Rimmers.
I've lost the trail.
Just like Red Dwarf.
Smooth.
Because this is the last episode where they mention looking for Red Dwarf. It doesn't get mentioned in the next couple of episodes. Apparently not.
Was that your research or does someone's found that?
Nah, that was a thingy on
the internet.
Don't mention Red Dwarf.
Because I've not watched.
I mean, Rimmerworld, they can't do, can they? Because it's, you know, it is.
It's basically they appear to have given up actively looking for Red Dwarf at this point because they've lost the trail.
Right. Yeah.
Just like you have.
Well, they did lose 3 weeks to the simulants, didn't they?
They did.
That's a very good point. Well said.
Yeah.
That's your phrase.
This scene also has my quotable dwarf of the episode, you never know. I do that. Obviously, I don't talk about myself because I have lots of sex. But if I'm mocking someone who hasn't had sex for a while, I will use you never know in a really patronizing way.
Do you have the triple thick condom before it, though?
Do they actually exist as a thing?
No.
I don't know whether they... You know, you get, like, super thin condoms. But do you get like the opposite end, like deep crust condoms?
You definitely get the black rib nobbler.
You do get black rib nobblers.
Yeah, but don't you have to catch them out of a canal?
A canal, yeah.
But I don't think you get triple thick condoms. I mean, again, I'm not above Googling it. Let's do it now. Lifestyle Extra Strength is the thickest condom available, which ensures maximum protection. Doesn't they
suck my thermos?
Yeah, well, you get extra thick, but you don't get triple thick. So there you go. There you go.
I feel an enlightened human being now.
Good.
We get a few what are guys. A couple of times they'll get one laugh in one, but the other one after the sci-fi convention doesn't hit. Because it's straight after the sci-fi convention. And the way, talking about way thick people say stuff, the way Rimmer says, love spuds on the barbecue. I'm never sure what to make of that. It's the way he says it though. I don't know what accent it is.
Yeah, Ace kind of becomes bad American accent, doesn't he? When Chris Barry over eggs Ace, and it's like, oh, he's still British. Why has he got an American accent? Because he's got muscles and charisma.
Well, is he British? Because he was born on Io, wasn't he?
Yeah.
One of Jupiter's moons,
yes, because it says on the previous episode, which we mentioned, what on Io? Which was a lovely touch. I love that.
But he's always sounded British up to this point, so I would guess...
Yeah, he's got a British accent. I believe it's a British colony.
Yeah, so an Io accent is Britishy. I'm not sure Britishy is a word.
Io!
So we get the idea that he's going to like sort of kill Dwayne by putting him in front. I thought that was beautifully played as well. And then that brings in the bazookoids. Now, we did talk about the bazookoids on the first episode of this series, I think.
Yeah, when they shot the siren.
So, yeah, and I have mentioned in the past, and I will mention it again here, they are fucking useless.
Yeah. Yep.
During this episode, they shoot a chain. They shoot. And nothing happens. They're like literally shooting. Somehow they managed to break down a door so they can get to an airlock to save Kat from being killed by Rimmer. But yet it can't like destroy anything else when they're shooting it in the middle of the hall.
Yeah. The consistency of the bazookoids is frustrating. They are powerful enough to blast away the snow during the sirens episode. One blast kills a siren when Rimmer shoots it, and then six blasts on the siren that gets in doesn't kill it. The inconsistency of the bazookoids is definitely a thing.
Crichton's gun, like a pistol with like a strap, that's proper cool.
Yeah, but it seems to have exactly the same level of power or lack thereof.
Mini
as
bazookoid.
So as I say, it's like, oh, it's this or it's that. I need to shoot at it. I think I've said in a previous episode when they shot like a screen or something and nothing actually happened. It's annoying. It's a little bit annoying. Dwayne's the one that finds it. So it's another one where Kat actually gets it sorted. Picks up the thermos, sees it. It's the emo hawk. It turns into a grenade. And Rimmer jumps on it. And obviously that's a heroic thing because he didn't know what was going to happen to it.
But luckily his hard light body is pretty much indestructible.
It is. And we can tell that from Legion when he had multiple hits.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yes.
Yes, he did it. Tried to protect those guys. So that's Rimmer. He wants to stay like that for 24 hours. And Dwayne Nibley says, suck my thermos. Which is just marvellous.
It is marvellous.
But one thing I failed to mention was about the actual trying to freeze it. So they actually freeze the Amor Hawk when after the grenade explodes. And while Rimmer is saying about can he stay in that for 24 hours, Dwayne says suck my thermos and accidentally sets off the freeze gun, at which point we finish.
Which is blatantly a fire extinguisher.
It is a fire extinguisher.
And yeah, we get a police squad ending.
Yes!
With them all frozen, but Dwayne moving in the background.
does feel like a bit of a police squad thing. Did you notice that the way he taps their head is the dun 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 start of the theme tune?
No, I didn't, but I like that.
Yeah, it is.
Brilliant.
And that calls the episode to an end. So have you got anything else to say about this episode?
Colin was absolutely bang on that this was fan service. Everything from the return of the emo hawk to the return of Ace to the return of Dwayne Dibley, it was very much fan service. And
it's a triple sequel is what it got described as in the DVD.
And do you know what?
Rundown thingy.
I'm okay with that. Yeah.
Totally. It's a great episode.
It's a really good episode.
It may be fan service, but we're fans, so that's who it's.
And fan service isn't necessarily always bad. In a lot of ways.
No, definitely not.
It's pretty cool as long as it's not done in a shitty way, and I don't feel like this was done in a shitty way at all. It's another fucking superb episode.
That's it. If it's done in a detrimental way, so if, like, they didn't put loads of cool jokes in there and they just thought they could just get away with having Dwayne Dibley turn up again, but not make it funny, then... But they're not going to do that, so...
We may have issues coming up in a future series,
yes,
about people turning back up. But one... But again, on a completely different note, in Red Dwarf 8, when we get, again, like a reference, like the Dibleys and stuff like that, then that's done extremely well. So there's cool. Little bits between here and there, which I think... So it'd be interesting to see when we do get to Season 7 and 8, just how that all transpires, really. Because, as I say, there's ways of doing it which is really good, and there's ways of doing it that aren't so good. So we'll go down there. So, Colin, any final thoughts on this and the rest of the series?
Not massively. Series 6 is... I always knew it was good, but I'd forgotten how fucking brilliant it is.
Mm.
It's so good. It may well be my favourite series of Red Dwarf, I think. So, yeah, it's so good. I just wish it continued at that level.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would, as I say, Series 7 is going to be interesting. I think the rest of the rest of the series are. I mean, I actually really, really enjoy Series 8, like I've said in the past.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you've said a few times.
So it's going to be interesting when we get to the bits where we might not always agree on stuff. But so far, I don't think anyone's had any major complaints of anything. So that's good.
Yeah.
Just one final thing we didn't mention at the beginning, but we'll mention it at the end here about the continuing fundraising for the Laredo Western Town. GoFundMe.
Hold on.
GoFundMe.
GoFundMe.
GoFundMe. GoFundMe. Oh my God. The people who
start again,
to this,
dear.
It's 2 minutes to midnight. There is
a Bassanine Maiden song. Awesome.
Yeah, it's a good tune, that, actually. Yeah. There's a crowdfunding GoFundMe for the Laredo Western Town, which unfortunately was hit by fire at the end of November in 2021, and that was the site of the Gunman of the Apocalypse, where Gunman of the Apocalypse was filmed. So they are trying to raise £25,000 at the moment. It's around £15,000, and they're looking to rebuild the site, as it's a private area which was used for filming. Like we said last week, for Grounds for Divorce by Elbow and Gunman the Apocalypse. So it's got a very much a rich Red Dwarf history. And as Mark will attest to, the best episode of the show. So
indeed,
if you can spare some change, please feel free to go to that GoFundMe and give what you can just to help with that cause. Because, as I say, we need to see that rebuilt, really. And it must be devastating for the people who actually live there. Who created it in 1971. So it must be heartbreaking for them. So we just want to raise awareness of that, and please give what you can. But that leaves us to say thank you for this week. Next week, we have a new guest. Mr. Latham's coming back.
Long as he doesn't bring Hob.
Colin, stay after the after class, please. Thank you.
So, it's bloody midnight.
I don't care. So Matt Latham will be back, and we'll be covering Rimmerworld, and then the following week, Out of Time, and that will be Series 6 completed. So until then, remember... Okay, go on. Midnight.
We didn't do plugs, but we're also on one minute.
It's 2 minutes to midnight. You can find Colin on Twitter. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find Mark on Twitter. We're on various different podcasts.
You can do that.
We're very tired. We're going to sleep now. Thanks.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found online at wemadethispod.com or on Twitter at We Made This Pod.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Elsewhere on We Made This.
The Failed Critics Podcast.
This Leatherface isn't a young guy anymore. He's a big guy. He's an older guy. Like, just sprint a little bit up the road and shoot him. Like, he's got a big chainsaw as well that if he's swinging it around, he's got to be careful with it or he's going to hurt himself. He's not going to be quick. Literally, some of them have got guns at some point in this film. Just sprint 20 yards up the road and shoot him.
There's a number of plot holes in this where the Hardesty character has the opportunity to point blank him and just doesn't do it. And it's just like, you've gone all this way, you've waited 50 years to see him again, and you could literally just blow his head off.
Yeah.
He's not posing any threat to you whatsoever. Yeah. In fact, he's sat on his bed waiting for you to do something.
And then you have a little chat with him. Just blow him away.
Free with this month's issue.
Quite often, things that go fast is good. But that's not, because it doesn't go really fast.
Yeah.
Just goes faster.
Yeah, and also when you've been ominously stalking, which is what that baseline does. Ominous. Then going fast is not, you know, like... Jason Voorhees doesn't run, does he? No.
He doesn't need to.
He remains ominous the whole time.
Yeah, but...
That's what this song should have done.
He's not Jason Voorhees. He's the T-1000's brother.
And did the T-1000 run? Not really.
Yeah.
A bit, but not a lot.
That bit when he's fucking chasing after them in the car, he's definitely running.
Maybe
quite
that's
famously.
What he did it. You know what?
Geek Polymath.
I don't think I'm a geek because I'm gay, but I think it fucking helped.
Well, listen, so I have theories about this.
Good.
Strap in for a conspiracy session.
Please.
It's all to do with being an outsider, which, of course, in as fingers crossed, as society progresses and advances, we will hopefully get to the stage where... just sexuality will have nothing to do with you being an insider or an outsider, but it's massively a part of it. There's a reason Russell T. Davis felt such a strong connection to Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And I think those kind of outsider bubbles overlap.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This Podcast Network.